This is a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. Go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
3CR would like to acknowledge the Kulin Nation, true owners, caretakers and custodians of the land from which we broadcast. 3CR pays respect to elders past and present of the Kulin Nation. We recognise their unceded sovereignty.
This is 3CR Breakfast. Oh, yeah. Alternative news, analysis, and current affairs. Monday to Friday, 7 a.m. to 8:30 a.m.
Only double.
Grab your pants.
Good morning, listeners. You are tuned in to Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 8:55 a.m. And it is Thursday, the 18th of September. I'm Priya, and I'm here in the studio with Zakia and Alice. Good morning.
Good morning, Priya. How are you?
I'm all right. How are you?
Yeah, it's been a week, but I'm having a good time.
It has absolutely been a week. Look, as Smash Mouth said in their hit song All Star, the years start coming and they don't stop coming. Yeah. They really don't stop coming. How are you doing?
I'm good. Good morning, Priya. Yeah. Welcome back.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, it's good to be back. I think, especially after taking some time away and inadvertently absorbing some traditional news media, I'm like, oh, I really want to come back to 3CR and actually get involved in making media again. So I'm glad to be here. Would you like to kick us off with the rundown for what we've got on today?
The first part of the interview, we have Tyler and Danny from Crisis Housing Reforms, a grassroots advocacy campaign focusing on change within Victorian crisis accommodation. We discussed two special reports released in late August this year from the Australian Institute of Health and Welfare concerning youth experiencing homelessness.
Well done on recording that interview. Do you want to go next?
Yeah, sure. And then after that, we will have the second part of our stories, our flats, our podcast that's running for the next 3 weeks after this.
Next 2 weeks after this.
2 weeks after this. This week on Our Stories, Our Flats, youth practitioner Sabrina Adam challenges the myth of ethnic enclaves, and the girls from Underground Women share their experiences of living in Carlton and what they'd like to see change.
Yes, amazing. And if you missed the first episode of Our Stories, Our Flats, you can head back to 3cr.org.au/Thursday-breakfast to get all of our podcasts. And that includes the first episode last week featuring, among others, the incredible Uncle Robbie Thorpe. And last week, I got the chance to catch up with Mananjali and South Sea Islander scholar and author Chelsea Watego to discuss the upcoming launch of Black Thoughts Matter, which is a selection of some of her most significant essays over the past decade. It was really an amazing conversation, and so I'm really excited to bring it to you all. And you can pre-order a copy of Black Thoughts Matter by heading to www.commonroom.au/editions/black-thoughts-matter. But don't worry, we will have the information in our show notes.
And then finishing the show, we will have Jade, a member of ARC Up, who will join us to speak about the importance of building migrant worker power in the liberatory struggle against colonialism, racism, class exploitation, and fascism on stolen land. ARC Up is an anarchist communist organization seeking to build migrant and indigenous class power through rebuilding a militant workers' movement, and is based on the lands of the Wurundjeri and Boonwurrung people of the Kulin Nation.
Yeah.
Find out more about ARC Up and the Migrant Building Power program by heading to arcup.org/migrantpower.
Yeah, I'm really excited about this one too. I think we're really at a moment, if you'll indulge me for a second, we're really at a moment, I think, where as we see the genocide continue to unfold in Gaza, but we also see an increasing disconnect and disaffection between political representatives and the broader population, and are also watching this disgusting resurgence of the far right. It seems like more important than ever to try and actually turn back to what it looks like to build, rebuild the left from the ground up. So hopefully it will be an inspiring interview to end on. We will be back to you shortly with the news headlines, so don't go anywhere.
Want to know what happened at the 2024 People's Blockade of the World's Largest Coal Port?
Come along to a special 3CR screening of Turning the Ship, the short film that explains all, and be inspired to join the blockade this year.
Revisit the epic event and hear how this incredible people-powered protestival came together.
Join us on Friday, 19th September at Evil Thoughts in East Brunswick.
Head to Rising Tide Victoria Insta or Facebook page to RSVP and to get all the details.
Rising Tide Victoria is a 3CR supporter.
Yeah, even Arnie in the 90s had a car that ran electric. They held back the tech. Shit. Now it's gotten hectic. They can't.
You're back on Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM.
These are the news headlines for Thursday the 18th of September. Journalist in Gaza says residents are witnessing a systematic unfolding as Israeli's bombardment of Gaza City forces families to flee repeatedly in the middle of the night. Fighter jets and drones hover at low levels while relentlessly explosives destroy displacements, camps, residential streets and tower blocks, killing hundreds of Palestinians, martyrs in the last few days alone. In the West Bank, Israeli forces killed two Palestinians during a raid and have withheld the bodies from Palestinian authorities. In a statement, the Palestinian-Israeli jet this week accused Israel of using the Gaza offensive to mask plans to annex the West Bank. With a visit from the United States Secretary of State viewed of sanction these actions.
In related news, a United Nations inquiry this week has found Israel is committing genocide through the mass killing of civilians, aid blockades, and the expansion of illegal West Bank settlements. But analysts warn the landmark ruling by the United Nations standards is unlikely to shift Israel's approach, as demonstrated by the escalation of Israel's assault on Gaza and the West Bank this week. In so-called Australia, though international law obliges states to act against Israel's breaches, the Albanese government continues to fail to match words with action by continuing trade and military ties with Israel despite mounting calls for sanctions and accountability.
In protest news in so-called Australia, pro-Palestine protesters in Naam brought the country's busiest container port to a standstill this week, blocking web docks container movements and demanding the Australian government cut ties with Israel. Meanwhile, in coordinated national actions, community members have occupied Labor MPs' offices to demand sanctions and arms embargoes. In Naam, Maersk Deramit Logistics Hubs was blocked and covered in paint as part of the global Mask Off Maersk campaign, highlighting the company's role in transporting more than $300 million in weapons components to arms manufacturers supplying Israel in the past 2 years.
Also in news this week, Race Discrimination Commissioner Giridharan Sivaraman has urged urgent and united action against Islamophobia in so-called Australia following the release of the Special Envoy to Combat Islamophobia's report. The report details the widespread and damaging impacts of Islamophobia across education and politics, with Muslim people facing disproportionate targeting by law enforcement and media. The Race Discrimination Commissioner backed reforms outlined in the National Anti-Racism Framework, stressing that structural solutions are needed to protect Muslim Australians and to rebuild trust.
In other news, at least 17 people have died and hundreds have been evacuated in Bali, Indonesia, after torrential rains triggered the the island's worst floods in more than a decade this past week, with islanders and rising waters and devastating communities. The extreme weather camps and widespread monsoon flooding across India and Pakistan, which has killed more than 900 people and caused evacuation of millions across the region.
Finally, in headlines, Australia's first national climate risk assessment was released this week, and environmental organisations are calling it a horror story. The report outlines that under a 3-degree warming scenario, parts of so-called Australia could see more than a 400% rise in heat-related deaths, and more than 1.5 million people at risk of sea level rise by 2050. In response to the report, environmental and community organisations are calling for urgent action, including a stronger 2035 emissions target from the government and ending new fossil fuel projects. Pacific Nations civil society groups have echoed the warnings, with some calling out Labor's recent approval for Woodside's Northwest Shelf gas extension, saying the extension would be an assault on Pacific communities. These have been the news headlines for Thursday, the 18th of September. You're listening to 3CR on 855 AM.
Want to become a socially progressive podcaster but don't know where to start?
3CR has a wealth of podcasting knowledge and experience, and we've developed a practical podcast training course to help community voices get into the world of podcasting.
Our 2-day in-station course is perfect for new podcasters or people who want to improve their skills and get some insider tips.
Enroll now for our October podcast course.
Full details at 3cr.org.au/podcast services.
Or call the station during business hours on 03 9419 8377.
Enroll now for our October podcast course.
Content warning. The following segment contains discussions of child and adolescent mortality and domestic violence. If anything covered causes distress or raises questions, you can contact the Suicide Callback Service on 1300 659 467. First Nations listeners can also call 13YARN. Today we're going to listen to the first part of an interview with Tyler and Danny from Crisis Housing Reform, a grassroots advocacy campaign focusing on change within Victorian crisis accommodation. We discuss two special reports released in late August this year from the Australian Institute of Health and Welfare concerning youth experiencing homelessness. The first report concerns children seeking support from specialist homelessness services who are unaccompanied, i.e. those aged 12 to 17 who were not accompanied by a parent or guardian, and the second is about children who have died who had a history of receiving specialist homelessness services support.
Good morning. Thank you both for joining me today. Before we get into it, I was hoping you could tell us a bit about yourselves, your history and experience with housing insecurity, homelessness, and seeking assistance.
So I'm Tyler. I first experienced homelessness when I was in my early teens, couch surfing and going through sleeping on the street and crisis accommodation and different family violence services, mental health services. I bounced around a lot. My referrals were passed around a lot because there were no single services that offered all of the assistance that I needed. I have been advocating in the service system for the last 3 years, trying to create change from the inside through advocacy and externally through activism. And that's why we're here to talk about the report, and that's what we're doing with Crisis Housing Reform.
My name is Danny, and I am also here today to advocate for the system and have been doing that for a while. And, yeah, given the report, there's a lot of highlighted things that need changing. So my experience was being a solo parent. I was 22 and had a 7-week-old baby and became homeless due to family violence. The system wasn't set up for me. I fell through the cracks of not fitting into any box that a system would be able to take me on. So, yeah, there was no refuge or anything. I had to couch surf with the baby until I found myself a private rental, which took several months of couch surfing every couple of weeks with a newborn. So, yeah, very passionate about this.
So, in regards to the reports, there are a few things that stood out to me, but I was wondering what, in your opinions, were some of the more important revelations.
Throughout the report, we realised that the rate of identified needs that aren't responded to, so there's a lot of needs that children need from services that were reported that their needs weren't being met. And if there was a referral, so say like to a psychologist, even if that referral wasn't picked up, it was still classified as that need was met. The data that was recorded but not reported on, and there was data that wasn't actually collected, it was missing from the report. And the fact that homelessness takes all of your capacity to survive, so anything you do beyond that is an extra, so it shouldn't be an expectation to be doing anything other than survive.
Speaking about the data in terms of errors and what might be missing, the first report analyses data from a few different angles, such as state and territory, age and sex, reasons for seeking assistance. I found it curious that it does not examine data by way of race or ethnicity. Given the fact that the ongoing impacts of colonialism disenfranchise First Nations people disproportionately, as well as, according to other AIHW data, about one third of those who access specialist homelessness services being First Nations people, why might this report omit that aspect for consideration?
Well, I think we have to agree that it's intentional that we as a country in so-called Australia use institutional violence as a means for population control, that the only reason for not including data about First Nations young people in these services is because it looks bad, because they don't want to report on their failures to support the First Nations communities. And in the data, it talks about child protection and child removal, but they don't want to report on the disproportionate impact on Indigenous communities. You know, they have other categories of reasons for seeking assistance, and that includes discrimination, including racial discrimination and transition from foster care and child safety placements and transition from custodial arrangements. But they're choosing not to report on stolen children, and they don't specify what kind of racial discrimination. And they claim that they don't report on discrimination due to an insufficient number, saying that discrimination is 0.7 of all reasons, which is practically impossible. That just isn't realistic in the world that we live in. I just believe that the government doesn't want to take responsibility for the harm that they're causing to Indigenous communities and also immigrants, because immigrant services were recorded as cultural services due to financing, but they didn't report the need for immigration services to avoid showing the lack of access to housing without citizenship. It's all about manipulating the data to have the numbers show what you want them to show.
Of the unaccompanied children who are experiencing homelessness when they began receiving support, 3 out of 4, or 77%, remained without secure, stable housing when their support period ended. What does that tell us about the systems that are currently in place?
Well, it tells us that it's not working, right? So youth allowance and job seeker payments aren't enough to cover rent. Like, they are below the poverty line. So youth allowance is 30% less than any other government payment and can only access if you're 16 and can prove it is unreasonable to live at home. People under 18 can't put their names on leases. So when they can't return home, they're forced onto the streets or into predatory sharehouse situations. With lower incomes and having lower minimum age, they are more vulnerable to exploitation. For example, if they did end up in a sharehouse that they could afford with youth allowance, they may be tempted for more money for things that would put them in unsafe situations. So the harm just continues. It takes longer than a year to get secure and stable housing. These are children. They don't have the legal right to independently set up bank accounts. Their age is just a huge barrier to accessing so many systems. There's no effective support or stable housing available. The system is set up to support adults. An adult, you would assume, knows how to cook a meal or budget, but a child doesn't. So if they can cook themselves noodles, doesn't mean that they can eat nutritiously, you know. There are some programs that work on developing skills, but it doesn't teach them enough, and it's not as readily available for, like, all of these children need that support. Being a youth-friendly service is more than using accessible language. It's accounting for the additional complex challenges that children face when experiencing homelessness, and that's something services aren't prepared to do right now. Learning how to live independently and manage traumas and challenges of homelessness takes too much capacity. There isn't enough capacity left over to also engage with work or education at the same time, but that is the expectation for many youth homelessness programs. So if a child is missing school because they're struggling, their housing becomes precarious yet again, compounding their trauma. The mental load of dealing with Centrelink is intense normally. These kids are also dealing with having less legal rights, general trauma and trauma from having payments cut that lead children to homelessness. Centrelink constantly makes housing precarious. Lack of integration of services, can't access mental health services when homeless, can't access homelessness services because you're too mentally ill. It's a circular system that passes the responsibility back and forth between government bodies without anyone actually caring for children or young people in crisis.
Unaccompanied children between the ages of 15 and 17 were twice as likely to not be enrolled in school, and also twice as likely to be participating in the labour force, i.e. working. While it is understandable that kids might be pressured for a variety of reasons into working instead of going to school, how does a withdrawal from education contribute to an individual's future housing insecurity?
There are social and developmental impacts of not being in school, but they're not being harmed by not being in school in any way that they aren't already being harmed by being homeless. Kids are leaving school because they have to work to pay rent because, as Danny said, youth allowance is below the poverty line. And when we asked a DSS representative why youth allowance was lower than other payments, they said that there's an understanding that responsibility for providing for a young person was shared between the parent and the government. But if a young person is on the unreasonable to live at home allowance, they've proven that they're not supported by their parents, but the payment is still not enough to sustain the young person independently. They just don't have any other options. They don't have the same access to tech or internet or education materials, and they can't get to school without a fixed address because school is catchment-based. So if you're not already enrolled, then you can't enroll. And if you are already enrolled, that creates a safety risk for kids who have left home because of family violence, because that is 8 hours a day where your potential perpetrators know where you are and know how to access you, and schools are required to contact your parents for permission because you're not old enough to sign off on paperwork to continue education. There is a mental health impact that we don't talk about of trying to manage your education while also managing the stress of homelessness. There is an understanding that you can't learn while you're in crisis, and homelessness is a crisis. I think rather than focusing on getting kids back into school, there should be a greater focus on getting kids into safe and secure housing, because school just isn't always the right place for all teenagers, and there's a slew of reasons why school might not be the best place at that particular time, whether it's care responsibilities or disability or mental health or poverty or lack of capacity, but housing is always the right place.
A little over two-thirds of unaccompanied children are female. This figure is similar across the board, with women making up 60% of the homeless population. Housing insecurity caused by escaping domestic violence and the increased vulnerability from pay inequality are two prominent reasons, but I wonder if you could elaborate on this disparity.
I think this is another kind of skewed data point, because in the second table there's an explanatory note that says unaccompanied children that put their sex down as other are counted as female. So this isn't a true representation of the gender split. And I think also there just is more girls and women specific housing. So there are more reported homeless girls and women because there are placements for them. People who are trans and gender diverse who don't have dedicated housing are forced to identify as female to be housed safely. And also recognizing that we live in a patriarchal society where boys and men's needs like healthcare and housing are more likely to be addressed earlier on, which leads to easy access to early intervention. While domestic violence is one of the primary reasons for homelessness, especially in children and young people. In children, it tends to come from family members. It's not intimate partner violence, it's family violence. And the gender difference in the way that children experience family domestic violence are significantly different than those experienced by adults. Of the forms of abuse that a child might experience, sexual abuse is recorded more often because it's considered less acceptable than other forms of abuse. And because of the legal requirement for harm to be proven beyond a reasonable doubt, which is easier to achieve in more extreme cases, reports of other types of abuse are less frequently recorded. And with bias in police and other potential reporters against the idea that boys experience sexual abuse, means that girls are more often reported as experiencing family domestic violence than boys, which skews the data. And then we know that people with more experiences are more likely to be referred into services, but those services aren't designed to deal with people with complex needs. They're designed to deal with straightforward cases who often aren't referred to services. And when looking through the data that wasn't included in the report, we saw that 20% of those who reported incest sexual assault weren't provided services or referrals for assault. And in 2023, 499 children reported to specialist homeless services that incest sexual assault was the reason for homelessness. And that's just reports to specialist homelessness services. And there is a pay inequality problem because boys are more likely to be hired than girls, and with age limitations, it is more difficult for young people to get hired, and there is a number of young people who are listing unemployment as a reason, and it's easier for young men to get on disability payments from Centrelink, which have the higher payment that gets them above the poverty line, and boys and men can more easily access diagnoses. Healthcare is especially inaccessible for teenage girls, and women have a higher rate of misdiagnosis, and there's a higher rate of homelessness for people with disability, which is worsened by managing that disability without healthcare, without access to healthcare or shelter or medication. So I think it all contributes. And I think there are a lot of reasons, but it all kind of comes back to this idea that women are weak and women are fragile. And we are more comfortable portraying them as needing saving than we are with portraying men as needing saving. And also, if cishet white men were the primary demographic in homelessness, homelessness would be solved. This is a tool of the government for population control, essentially. This is how they manage the people that are less controllable. Cishet white men don't need managing.
You're listening to 3CR on 855 AM. It is 7:27 in the morning. You've just been listening to part one of an interview with Tyler and Danny from Crisis Housing Reform, discussing two recent government reports concerning youth experiencing homelessness. Tune in next week for part two, and you can find out more about their work and get involved on Instagram at Crisis Housing Reform.
3CR would like to thank our sponsors, Earth Greetings, cards that connect, care, and celebrate. Support wildlife and habitat with every purchase. Inspired by nature, giving back to the planet. Learn more at earthgreetings.com.au.
You're listening to Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. Maybe we'll give you a weather check as well. It's supposed to be a maximum of 20 degrees Celsius, minimum of 7 degrees. And at the moment, it feels apparently like 5.3 degrees, though the temperature, the thermometer is reading 8.2. It looks like it's going to be a cloudy day, but no rain forecast. And a moderate UV index. So please, no sunscreen necessarily, but wear a hat if you're outside. We are now going to play the second episode of Our Stories, Our Flats. And this week on Our Stories, Our Flats, youth practitioner Sabrina Adem challenges the myth of ethnic enclaves, and the girls from Underground Women share their experiences of living in Carlton and what they'd like to see change. Our Stories, Our Flats is produced by Ayan Shirwa.
Our Stories, Our Flats acknowledges the traditional owners of the Kulin Nations. We pay our respects to their elders, past and present. Welcome to Our Stories, Our Flats, a four-part podcast series about living and thriving in the Carlton Public Estates. Our Stories, Our Flats was created by and for the residents of the Carlton Flats. It is a free CR podcast. Special thanks to the City of Melbourne for helping us share it with the world. Our Stories, Our Flats is written, produced and edited by Ayan Shoiwa. Narration by Raven. As someone who grew up in the flats during my early years, I had a fulfilling childhood. I had community, youth clubs at my doorstep. I lived in the radius of good schools, which meant I had opportunities that were gifted to me simply by the location of my home. That's all going to change for many young people when they're relocated out of Carlton. On the show today, we hear from youth practitioner Sabrina Adam. And joining us later are the brilliant girls from the Underground Women. Critics of public housing often cite the adverse effects of ethnic enclaves and use it as a justification to demolish people's homes. That's why it's essential to hear from residents like Sabrina Adam, who were challenging the scripts peddled by government and policymakers.
My name is Sabrina. I've lived in Carlton for over 20-something years, and I turned 25 yesterday, so I'm 25 years old. So I moved to Australia in 2002, and I was born in Sudan. And not a lot of people know this about me, no. And we first came and got moved to Altona, I think. That lasted for like a month or two, and then we got moved to Carlton, specifically like 510. And I spent like over 10 years living in Carlton, specifically in 510, and then we got moved over to a different building. My favourite memory growing up was definitely going downstairs like summer nights and seeing all these different families downstairs with like balls of fruit that they would bring down or snacks or cakes and just going to every single station, taking a bit of food from everyone and then going off to play. Summer in Carlton is, honestly, it's a concept in itself. Like you were there or you weren't. But if you had to paint a picture, it was like, it was really hot in the buildings and families usually had like, you know, that massive bulky AC or like no AC. So everyone was downstairs and the breeze was just phenomenal. Imagine like picnic mats actually spread out across like a massive field. Like that's the vision. And every single table has like different foods from wherever they're from, and then a bunch of random snacks, lollies, and then fruit balls. And you had access to all of it. And you just had to go play. And then when you were hungry, top up on someone's picnic blanket and then go back to play. You stayed outside until your parents went up or a relative of yours went up and you were expected to follow. Some people like would go up when their neighbors went up. But essentially, as soon as you don't have an adult that you know downstairs, it was time to wrap it up. I noticed that things were different when I moved to a private school and no one lived in public housing. And I think even when I noticed the class difference, I still didn't pick up that there was a difference until I actually heard some of the students talk about having relatives in public housing. And then they spoke down on those people. And I was so shocked because they didn't know I lived in public housing, but it wasn't something I was hiding. It was just something that never came up. And so when I heard them speak like that, I got really defensive. And I think they were associating it with like, that's definitely like a druggy area. And if you come out from there, like you ain't shit. And I was so angry. And I was not notoriously like someone reactive. So I didn't often react. So when I did, it was like, oh, what's wrong with her? But it was so personal because this is my home. What are you talking about? Yeah, there was a lot of opinions about growing up in the States. Yeah, I think there was an image of what people had for what someone who'd been in public housing looked like. You were immediately a bit more aggressive, a bit raw. And? And what? Like, now I'm tougher. And what? And not only that, like, I didn't know how, like, sheltered and isolated people were. Like, I thought everyone had the same lived experiences. Like, I didn't know anything else. So even people talking about what they did on school holidays, I was like, what do you mean? You didn't just go downstairs and have fun with your friends? Like, what?
A justification for tearing down the flats is that it creates ethnic enclaves. In this next segment, Sabrina unpacks this narrative.
I think in your formative years, you need a bit of a bubble so you can be so self-assured and, like, know that you have a world to rely on. It's like, it's so isolating being thrown out and experiencing so many different worlds at such a young age. Like, you also need your foundation, your grounding, your community. And I think that that's the kind of role it played. So I grew up going to youth services a lot. And it was just a place that you and your friends would go hang out. That was the norm. And then I grew up and I actually worked at a program called Underground Women's. That was created out of young women from Carlton who grew up and said that they were going to run things for their own communities and still exist to this day. And it was just such an important space. I think when we were younger, it was important because it meant that we got to experience things outside of the bubble, and it was like a nice experience to go out and do things that you would never do normally. But now it's so much more important because we aren't hanging out outside in Carlton downstairs. We're not knowing our neighbours in the way that we used to. And so these spaces kind of work to build those friendships rather than exposure. Before it was a bit more exposure because we all knew each other, but now it's definitely like to build relationships and repair what was undone. Yeah, it's so scary, the idea that like once they leave, they won't have access to youth services and spaces where they can connect with other young people in the same way that they get to now. And it's so scary, it's the idea that, you know, the sense of community that you had will disappear. I think that that's, oh, yeah. I don't know how to say what I want to say, but it's just, it's so sad. And I think about it from my sister's lens. Like, I grew up, I had community, I had reassurance from people around me. I had terrible experiences that I got to come back and tell my friends about and was reaffirmed and reassured. And I think about my sisters who, alhamdulillah, like they have relationships with other Carlton girls, but it's like they could easily lose that if everyone dissipates, essentially. And they'd have to rely solely on social media to maintain those relationships, but that's obviously not the same. My reservations about the demolition was how people were informed. I have people I know who work in government who live in those buildings, and they were notified at the same time as the general public. And the way the general public were notified was insane. It was like they found out with everyone else. There was no like notice provided. They have everyone's address. They could have sent anything beforehand. I think it was really distasteful. Also considering that the hard lockdown has just happened and people are feeling really empowered. And now it just felt like a stab in the back after they had to look out for each other that they said, oh, we're actually going to dismantle all this. This will cease to exist in a few years. It was really gross.
Living in proximity to people from similar backgrounds has many benefits. It can strengthen your sense of identity and culture and create strong social networks, which we know is key to combating loneliness and isolation. Not everyone living in these flats is affected by stigma. Many of us are proud of being raised in a neighborhood with culture, community, and resourcefulness. Residents like Sabrina Adam should be listened to and consulted with if we want to get a fuller understanding of the situation on the ground. You're listening to Our Stories, Our Flats, a 3CR podcast by and for the residents from the Carlton Public Flats.
La 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 la.
The Underground Women is a space for young people who live and work in the city of Melbourne. The girls meet weekly to learn, play, and hang out in a safe and supportive environment. Ayan met up with the girls during one of their catch-ups at the local gym.
Hi, my name is Siham. I've lived in Carlton since 2022.
Hi, my name is Yaz and I've lived in Carlton since 2024.
Hi, my name is Rahima and I lived in Carlton for 11 years.
Hi, my name is Maida and I lived in Carlton since 2024.
My favorite memory was probably when I first came here and I used to play outside till night.
My favorite memory in Carlton was when I would go outside and play basketball with my friends.
I like living in Carlton because there's like a lot of people living near you, so if you need something, you have neighbors really close to you.
The Somali community is like really big, so everyone's basically like a family here.
There's shops near you and everything is like not too far away like other suburbs. My favorite thing about Carlton is that I have many friends to hang out with and they live nearby.
One thing I don't like about Carlton is that the safety here is not really good. Like there's unsafe people around and it's not good for the children.
The fire alarms go off a lot and it's really irritating.
When you wake up and you already hear like construction noise and it's like really annoying compared to different suburbs. In different suburbs you can hear like the bird like saying kaka, kaka.
I come here so I can like socialize with my friends more and have fun and like be more off of devices and yeah, be more social.
My favorite thing I've done so far was going to the bounce with my friends, and I really liked it.
My favorite thing about Underground Women's is how, like, every week or, like, in the holidays, we always have, like, a fun activity to do, but my favorite was probably the pool party.
If I could change one thing about Carlton is the buildings, because it's really, like, rusty and it's very disgusting, and sometimes there's, like, animals and they, like, do some inappropriate stuff around there.
Every time we go in the lifts in the morning, there's like piss.
One thing I wish I could change about Carlton is how when you're in like your house, it's like everything's so cramped.
One thing I would change about where I live is the fact that the apartments are not soundproof and you can hear like your upstairs neighbors like walking around and stuff. It's pretty irritating.
People that don't even live in the building just come inside and then they just do whatever they want.
My thoughts on the redevelopment program, if they're gonna like take down the buildings, that means we're gonna move somewhere else and then it's gonna be really different to change.
I wouldn't want them to like get rid of the buildings because it's like a really good community here and we would have to like go somewhere new. Overall, Carlton is like a really great place, even though like it has some ups and downs. I would personally recommend living in Carlton.
That was the Underground Women discussing life on the flats. Reflecting on this interview, it's inspiring to hear how deeply the young girls care about their community, while also being frank about the challenges they're witnessing. We should never underestimate the wisdom of young people. They are connecting dots that adults may sometimes miss. Decision makers should engage with young people, not only for their innovative ideas, but also because every voice matters when it comes to housing justice. Wherever you stand on the issue of redevelopment, it's important to note that the community, especially young people, know precisely what they want to see change. In the next episode, residents share their thoughts on accessibility and safety in the flats. To learn more about housing justice, head over to our 3CR website at 3cr.org.au/Our Stories, Our Flats. Our Stories, Our Flats is written, produced and edited by Ayan Shoiwa. Narration by Raven.
We're back on Thursday morning breakfast on 3CR 855 AM.
I hope you enjoyed the interview. Our Stories, Our Flats.
Where youth practitioner Sabrina Adem challenged the myth of ethnic enclaves, and the girls from Underground Women shared their experiences of living in Carlton and what they'd like to see change. Where can people find the show notes? For show notes, you can visit 3cr.org.au/Our Stories, Our Flats.
Want to know what happened at the 2024 People's Blockade of the World's Largest Coal Port?
Come along to a special 3CR screening of Turning the Ship, the short film that explains all, and be inspired to join the blockade this year.
Revisit the epic event and hear how this incredible people-powered protestival came together.
Join us on Friday, 19th September at Evil Thoughts in East Brunswick.
head to Rising Tide Victoria Insta or Facebook page to RSVP and to get all the details.
Rising Tide Victoria is a 3CR supporter. Yeah, even Arnie in the 90s had a car that ran
electric. They held back the tech. Now it's gotten hectic. They can't. You're listening to Thursday Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM, and it is 7:45 in the morning on Thursday, the 18th of September. Last week, I got to catch up with Mananjali and South Sea Islander scholar and author Chelsea Watergo to discuss the upcoming launch of Black Thoughts Matter, a selection of some of the most significant essays that she has published over the past decade across a variety of digital platforms. Out with Common Room editions later this year, Black Thoughts Matter provides critical context to Watergo's public scholarship, honouring the Black thinkers that have shaped her intellectual and political formation to date. It is a testament to the love, power, and joy that is at the heart of Black thinking and writing in the fight against racial violence in so-called Australia. And you can pre-order a copy of Black Thoughts Matter by heading to commonroom.au. Look, first of all, Chelsea, thank you so much for speaking with me about this collection. It really is an honour and a privilege to be able to discuss it with you.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, of course. Now, I guess the first thing that I wanted to touch on was to get your reflections on the process of bringing these pieces of writing together into the book and, you know, seeing your own writing and thinking transform over time and what the feeling was like of, you know, curating this collection of work that you've done over so many years on race and coloniality in this place.
Yeah, look, it was a strange feeling because it's marked that the decision to do this book was sort of marked 10 years of doing the online editorial essay type writing, which I fell into, and it shows in the earlier works of the commissioned pieces that I did to review a TV show for The Conversation and things like that. And, yeah, look, it was a bit uncomfortable reading some of the earlier work, but I used that to prepare the forewords for each of the chapters because what I decided to do when looking at, and I tried to find as many as I could. I haven't got all of the articles I've written in that decade in that format. I had to think about which ones I stay in because it's a very, very thick book already. So I had to, you know, keep some out of some that were too repetitive. But what I ended up doing was organising them thematically and chronologically. And through that I could see the patterns of the thinking, the growth, what it is that got me most wild during that time, because they each were written on their own and at a moment, at a time, often with, you know, 24-hour, 48-hour deadline of 800 words that I always managed to creep into 1,500 words. And so to look at it as a body of work and to see the trends and the themes, not just in what I wrote about, but also how I developed as a writer. And that was part of the reason of producing the book, was to have a holding place for these articles that are anywhere and everywhere, but to use it as the cautionary tale for those that are writing. And I, you know, I was honest about critiquing my own work and the limitations of my work. And see, I like critique, so I did enjoy pulling apart what I did, what I believe I did wrong, or the limitations of the work at that particular time. And it wasn't like a self-deprecating thing. I actually really like understanding how to write better. Yeah. Some of my colleagues were a bit, were concerned about my critique of myself, but it wasn't about, wasn't beating myself up at all. I was just, for me, it's just being honest and going, well, if knowing what I know now, this is what I would do differently. And I hope that others could, you know, learn from that and that'd be useful for them.
It is, in a sense, like a very generous demonstration of a process of self-reflection on the work that you've done and how your thinking has transformed over time. And something that really struck me looking at your writing in this collection was
the way that you keep coming back to Black knowing as both embodied, but also something that is fundamentally relational. And I was wondering if you could talk maybe about the practice of Black knowledge production and the way that that is something that lives in the body, but it also lives in community and in conversations with other people who are thinking through this from their own experience and theorizing from that.
Yeah, so I mean, part of the reason for writing this as well and writing it as a kind of, I don't know, it's not a manual, but sort of as a, writing to the other writers, was, I guess, in response to it, just it happens so frequently in conversations I have with other writers and thinkers, particularly Black fellows and people of colour. You know, such is the nature of racial violence where the process of dehumanisation where you're not allowed to feel and you can't possibly know shit. And so it's really speaking to Uncle Joe Guy, offered the words of wisdom at one of our Black writing retreats, and he said to all of us, you have to speak to the Black part of your mind. And, you know, so much we've experienced the violence of educational institutions from primary school to high school to universities, where we come to believe that we can't know, that we can't feel. And, and I still experience from, academic peers who dismiss my work. I remember being chastised once on Twitter for speaking of the Black body by someone who was not a Black body. And so it is a bit of a fuck you to the violence that I've encountered as a Black thinker, but also as a pep talk to other Black writers to go, no, don't listen to the shit they're telling you. Be in community with your own people. And let that be the compass for what, the ethical and moral decisions you make as a writer, because we know that when we're being told what a good writer is, what a good academic is, it means being a white writer, being a white academic, and centering white supremacy. And so it was, and it is hard to fight that. And I always think about, I know the look in Black fellas' eyes who have forgotten the power of their knowing or are battling with believing in the power of their knowing because of all of the encounters they've had. And so it is a speaking back to that of that, and I have a love-hate relationship with lived experience. This is not just about, well, this is my experience, and let me universalize it or weaponize it against others, but really recognize the unique vantage point that we each bring in understanding this world and collectively how powerful these can work together. But yeah, so it's some of the, there's some forwards that have some tips, and they're the kind of things that I found myself saying too many times to Black PhD students or undergrad students or just fellow writers. And I so wanted to have a holding place too for that advice to go, here, this is a pep talk. You don't listen to that because it is an overwhelming presence in that regulates that polices Black thought. What is possible.
I did want to turn to asking about anti-racism at this time and the centrality of Black thought from here in terms of understanding racism and what to do about racism. I think maybe this is a potentially an artifact of this artificial splitting off of multiculturalism from Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people's concerns. But how do we think anti-racism from here, and what are the offerings that your book makes in that regard?
Yeah, huge questions. Look, I have this thing that, there's this positioning of Black fellas as victims of racism and that we occupy the lowest rung of the racial hierarchy. And because of that location, we can't possibly know anything. So we're subjects to be felt sorry for, even by settlers of colour. And what we've been seeing in the last fortnight, it was Black fellas that were putting their bodies on the line to insist that all people had a right to belong here. like the most fiercest, inclusive, anti-racist research and action has come from blackfellas. You know, and I always say that, you know, blackfellas have never pulled out our flags to tell people to go back to where they come from. I mean, even on Invasion Day protests, what blackfellas are fighting for is a respectful coexistence. You know, a call for humanity beyond hierarchy, to understand how we're better in relationship with each other. And it made me so proud. Here in Southeast Queensland, we had Uncle Coco Wharton taking on the racists in the middle of the city and telling the young fellas to stay out of it because he's got it, holding the front line. That wasn't a fight for black fellas. That was against fighting against immigration. And he was on the side fighting for immigration as a black fella. Over on Stratty, we had Uncle Dale Rusker and mob defending a flagpole that is being taken down because there's a Palestinian flag also flying alongside the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander flag. It makes me so proud as a black fella to see our people on the front lines fighting for all people of colour, all marginalised people. And so that we need to shift this orientation of black fellas as being passive subjects and victims of racism that need to be felt sorry for, and in fact see black fellas and the work that's on the front line, the strategizing, the theorizing that's taking place, to inform a more powerful collective anti-racist movement. And that's certainly what our approach was this year with this symposium of bringing together people in the fight, but centering Indigenous humanity and Indigenous sovereignty. And it's such a beautiful and inclusive space to think in the midst of the injustice and the fuckery of it all.
What you've said there, I think, also touches on something that I really wanted to pick up on, which is it's not, in these essays, it's not about a debunking of whether or not, you know, black thought is vital and necessary to, you know, understanding racism in this place, racial violence in this place. It's about shifting the terms of reference. And so I wanted to ask you about what a black terms of reference looks like when it comes to, yeah, not just pushing back, but narrating otherwise.
Yeah, well, look, I think, you know, we're only just starting that conversation. I mean, I think amongst black fellas, there are some very clear clear frameworks in which we operate. I think that has been contested, particularly in more recent years. There has been certainly a conservative black political movement that has, you know, caused some shifts around what is considered black Indigenous anti-racism in this place. But I think it's still sad to say that it's still very new that there are people theorising and doing work on anti-racism that continue to erase Indigenous knowledges and practice. Like, we are still working very hard to introduce people to our black warriors and to not just go, well, look, this is who they are, but what can we learn from them? Let's go to their writings, their speeches. Let's understand them. Let's celebrate them in the way in which we love to celebrate the, you know, black critical race scholars from elsewhere. And so and that's very much been part of our work, both at ICRR with Karumba and in the writings that we do, is make visible the black theorists of this place, because there still is this, even in anti-racist spaces, there is still a very Terranullius take when it comes to both research and practice in this space. And so I think it's still it's early days. I mean, I see the way in which I have race scholars dismiss my work, who disparage it. I mean, part of the reason of writing this book too was a bit of a spite project, in that I was chastised for writing online editorials by most of my, you know, senior supervisors, and I was criticised. It wasn't seen as scholarly. It was too political. And so the fact that even with the academic track record as a Black professor that there's still this active erasure of Black thought is a thing. We have, I think it's really exciting times for us, particularly at Corumba, where we've got the likes of Uncle Philip Mills, Uncle Graham Brady, who are doing their PhDs. And, you know, it is such a blessing and a privilege to be learning from them. There aren't the texts written that capture the deep philosophical work that they have embodied. So it's, to me, it's still, sadly, a work in progress. And I think that's our role as scholars. If we say we're, you know, taking up the national science and research priority of elevating Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander knowledge systems, then it should start here. And we need to think about how we operate differently as academics and move away from this wanky idea of what good scholarship is.
I mean, perfectly put. Thank you so much. And I was going to ask about, you know, creating the conditions for Black thought and thinkers to thrive. And I was wondering if you wanted to finish with any reflections on that.
Look, the fun part about writing this book is that every new piece, which so each, it has a collection of the old writing, but each chapter has a new foreword, which is kind of the, you know, things I wish I did differently or, you know, tips that relate to some of those articles. But every one of those, the new writing was written and shared with our reading group that we run every Wednesday at Corumba that Dr. Amy Maguire facilitates. And so my writing has always been a collective process, both in the edits, but even in the formation of ideas. I think on Instagram, most of the thinking for this book happened on Blackfella Twitter back in the day when it used to be a great place to think and play. So the work has always been a collective process. I mean, I like being alone in my office to write, but I also love sharing and thinking, getting feedback. And I rouse people and say, don't tell me what you like about it, tell me what's wrong about it. Because once you publish, it's out in the world forever. So I want people to be honest with me about what's wrong with it as much as possible. But I really enjoy reading other people's work. And I have a big thing about welcoming critique. If someone's giving you critique, they're helping you. They're showing you your blind spots. It is a gift to give critique. And now I'm getting better. I don't always give critique. I don't always give away my thinking because people do steal it while demonizing me for it. So I'm a bit more cautious about what I give. But when I give critique, it is a gift to go, have you thought about? And I think that many of us as writers need to think about how do we practice giving and receiving critique and creating the spaces where we can make that happen. And I'm very fortunate to be in community with amazing thinkers who share so generously. And it makes writing even more fun than the solitary endeavor that I also enjoy. So my encouragement is don't never write on your own. Find your people, share your writing, read other people's work and have fun in that process.
3CR is about community and we welcome your participation at the station.
3CR is open to a wide diversity of volunteers and is a great way to connect with Melbourne's activist community.
Have you ever thought about volunteering, doing a reception shift, getting a program on air,
training in radio skills or contributing to one of the station's committees?
There are many ways to be involved at 3CR.
To find out more, go to 3cr.org.au and get in touch.
You're tuned in to Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. It is 8:04 in the morning and you just heard a conversation that I got to have last week with Mananjali and South Sea Islander scholar and author Chelsea Watego about the upcoming launch of Black Thoughts Matter, which is a selection of some of the most significant essays she's published over the past decade. And Black Thoughts Matter is going to be out soon with Common Room Editions. And you can pre-order a copy at commonroom.au/editions/black-thoughts-matter. And I believe there's also going to be a wonderful interview with Chelsea coming up on 3CR's Women on the Line program. And so to find out more about Women on the Line, you can head to 3cr.org.au/women-on-the-line. Shout out, Fung. And it is, well, look, we've got one more interview coming up for you today. But if you are just joining us, earlier in the show, we heard the first part of an interview with Tyler and Danny from Crisis Housing Reform on two special reports released this year from the Australian Institute of Health and Welfare. And we also heard the second out of four episodes of Ayan Shirwa's podcast, Our Stories, Our Flats, and this week featured youth practitioner Sabrina Adem and the girls from Underground Women. And to find the show notes, you can head to 3cr.org.au/ourstoriesourflats.
Hi!
I'm Jeffrey.
I'm Alphonse.
I'm Erwin.
And we are from the Voice of West Papua.
Tuesday, 6:30 until 7:30 p.m.
News and music from West Papua.
If you're a renter with problems such as repairs, getting your bond back, negotiating a rent hike, or facing eviction, it helps to know your rights. For free information and advice on renting, you can visit Tenants Victoria at www.tenants.vic.org.au, Arnica Legal at www.anikalegal.com, or contact your nearest community legal centre. The government is planning to demolish and redevelop high-rise public housing towers in Melbourne. If you're living in a public housing tower and need free legal advice about your options, find your nearest community legal centre at www.fclc.org.au. The Federation of Community Legal Centres is a 3CR supporter.
Benvenuti, benvenuti al programma Radio Filet.
Mercoledì pomeriggio dalle 18:30 alle 19:30.
And for those who don't speak Italian, that's Wednesday evening, 6:30 to 7:30 p.m.
You'll hear from multi-generational Italian voices coming together to connect and learn and discuss Italian culture.
And politics.
And politics.
Radio File, building bridges between the diaspora.
The program will be part in Italian, part in English. So
practice your Italian or hone your listening skills.
Radio File, la voce alternativa della comunità italiana a Melbourne.
Tune in to 3CR 855 AM or you can listen online at 3cr.org.au.
Radio Filef.
You're listening to Thursday Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. And we are now joined for our final interview by Jade, who is a member of ARCOP. And Jade's going to be speaking about the importance of building migrant worker power in the liberatory struggle against colonialism, racism, class exploitation, and fascism on stolen land. ARCOP is an anarchist communist organization seeking to build migrant and indigenous class power through rebuilding a militant workers' movement, and is based on the lands of the Wurundjeri and Bunurong peoples of the Kulin Nation. And you can find out more about ARCOP and the Migrants Building Power program, which we will discuss today, by heading to arcup.org/migrant power. But for now, good morning, Jade.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, of course. So could you start off just by telling us about what ARCOP is and how the organization came into existence? Because I think it's pretty interesting looking at the amount of work and time that's gone into building a base to start organizing from.
Yep, sure. So ARCUP is an anarchist communist organization, like you said, that has a focus on building migrant and indigenous class power. What that means is we're class struggle anarchists, and that basically means we think rebuilding a militant workers' movement is desperately needed if we want to regain like a serious form of leverage when it comes to winning demands, but also to keep any wins off the past. So like just as a bit of context, we started building this org since 2021 because we saw the need to build something that can last and deal with common issues we see on the left in Nam. So there's so many groups and campaigns with like, you know, all sorts of politics, sometimes contradictory aims according to anarchist communists, and also sometimes unaccountable leadership. So it can be really challenging to navigate and figure out by yourself if you're newly getting into political work. We wanted to build like an organization with structure and is directly democratic, something with clear politics and strategies that we can communicate so people feel like they can fully consent to joining. And then also like something that is focused on cultivating more race and class marginalized organizers who can then in turn reach their own communities with anarchist values and strategies. So yeah, that's sort of the summary.
Yeah, awesome. And I think it is something that we're seeing more and more, you know, vitally necessary to really start rebuilding and rethinking what the left looks like in this place. So on that point, what do you see is the importance of political education in rebuilding and transforming the left on these stolen lands and meeting the current political moment where we're seeing the brutality of colonialism ongoing and border violence increasing, and we're also seeing yet another resurgence of the far right that's been emboldened by, you know, many years of pandering by liberal centrism?
So political education is how we seek agreement with those who we organize with, because we think shared ideas flow into shared strategies, and that's what keeps our movements united and strong. So, you know, if we want to fight these immense systems of, like, colonialism and fascism and capitalism and stuff, you know, we have to get organized in a serious way and build power. But when I say power, power isn't just having, like, the agency to do stuff or, like, a basic understanding of oppression. We're talking about building class power as something that needs to be weaponized for struggles around indigenous sovereignty and migrant justice and so on and so forth. So just to give an example, you know, of like when, like how we're lacking power. So for example, like the bail laws introduced at the end of last year, First Nations, you know, they've been campaigning for a long time to improve those bail laws, and they did, yet like the government is able to walk their wind back anytime they want. So what we need is power that can help us keep those wins. And we think workers' power is that leverage, because workers can hurt profits. And there's no shortcuts to building this kind of power, because it often requires meeting working-class people where they're at. So, yeah, to I guess like get back to the importance of political education. In ARCUP, we have introductory workshops to anarchism that basically covers our group positions on a variety of topics, just to give, you know, people a clear picture of what they'd be joining. And then internally, we also have like more political education that basically builds people up to be solid organizers, whether it's addressing conflict and harm, security, workplace organizing, revolutionary history, and more. And yeah, I guess this kind of education, it's always ongoing for every member in our group, because as the world changes, we need to update what we know too. And so it's not about like knowing the right stuff to say. It's about putting what we learn into practice over and over again within our strategies, within our tactics. So our org, we're not reactive to what's happening around us. And yeah, it's a project that has longevity.
Yeah, I really appreciate what you said about meeting people where they're at and the importance of continued learning, because it, I think, I guess connects to some concerns and stresses and tensions that we've seen across the left, you know, for a long time about, as you said, maybe learning how to know the right thing to say, but not necessarily connecting the, you know, felt understandings of injustice and oppression mm-hmm. with a coherent political analysis and then a revolutionary strategy. So to what extent do you see mainstream leftist groups grappling with the relationship between workers' struggle and then issues of anti-fascism, anti-racism, and anti-colonialism? And what does anarchism offer in this regard?
Yep. So many socialist and communist orgs here do push for workers' struggle to be weaponized against broader social issues. But I guess with anarchist communist strategies, we tend to offer an approach that is more about us as workers fighting alongside other workers. So while we aren't against rank and file led, you know, takeovers of like musty union leadership, it's important to us that any formal union leadership, they have strict mandates to fill determined by an engaged membership base. So we don't like top-down approaches where union leaders dictate strategy for workers to carry out. Neither do we like unions cozying up with the Labour Party. So these are the kinds of things, you know, we'd make arguments against when organizing on the level of the rank and file in our unions and at our workplaces. So instead, we would like encourage workers to gradually build up confidence through taking their own direct action at work, which, you know, can look like a lot of different things, and defying any union hacks that stifle work power. So we would seek to build a workers' movement that, like, ultimately tries to defy anti-union law as well. Almost identical laws, you know, have been smashed before, and that's the only way to workers' power that can win the demand of all human struggles. Plus, I think, like, when it comes to sort of, like, more minority issues, like First Nations and migrant worker issues, we would also push for those to be taken seriously and supported by the rank and file of our unions. And when it comes to, like, anti-fascism, we want to build a mass movement, not a tiny squad of elite street fighters. So we want a movement that involves the unions and a worker-led push that sees attacks against migrants as attempts to divide the working class and make us easier to pick off, you know, by capitalists. So, you know, with the March for Australia movement, they're marching in the opposite direction to better wages, better housing, better standards of living. And our obligation is to intervene and make arguments that don't sacrifice the biggest victims of global capitalism, which is First Nations people and migrants. We don't sacrifice them to a protectionist, white nationalist right wing.
Yeah, and, you know, something that I've seen come up in a lot of conversations around the left is a recognition that, you know, while we might be categorically opposed to what various factions of the right and far right are pushing, it is undeniable that in some ways they've been able to harness the sentiment that, you know, at least people that are in the disenfranchised white working class, for example, might feel to some sort of ideological program, even if it's not necessarily completely coherent. So I wanted to ask you on this about the Migrants Building Power program that ARCUP is doing and, you know, how this is attempting to actually do that work of building power and building solidarity while also, you know, fostering critical consciousness.
Yeah. So Migrants Building Power is one of our programs we've been working on for a while. Migrant workers, they're the backbone of the economy. During COVID lockdowns, we saw that clearly with many of the essential workers being migrants. So we think, you know, if you want a strong workers movement, you need migrant workers and their working class communities involved. Our analysis of the union movement currently is that it doesn't sufficiently support migrant workers to get organized. Of course, you know, there's a small number of unions who do put some resources in this area, and there's initiatives to learn about rights and stuff like that. But also, you know, we understand that with the anti-union laws, unions today, they're often afraid to break the law due to the material interests of, you know, like maintaining their salaries as union employees and bureaucrats. So we think engaging migrant workers involves a little bit of extra specific effort and consideration. And since migrants are not often in their unions, we want to provide like a space outside of unions and workplaces to gather, learn, build solidarity between communities, and also like strategize for how to make unions more serious about migrant issues, whether it's, you know, changing the visa system or the encroaching white nationalism. And so, yeah, you know, like if, you know, unions are incompatible, the current unions are incompatible with this sort of project, we'd also be open to starting new unions so that, you know, migrant working class power can exist and sort of like, yeah, be determined by migrant workers. So I guess like a bit more about the program. We have workshops on migrant exploitation, on how migrants have rights, you know, how they're, but they're still hard to enforce with the way that bosses use the visa system to coerce and threaten migrant workers into silence. We have a workplace organizing training tailored to migrant workers here and with case studies that are from here, which we envision will be used for migrant workers to bring their sympathetic workmates along to learn workplace organizing. And then we have a network to keep in touch and share projects and campaigns and try to like stitch together organizing efforts to see what solidarity might be possible. So that's the picture of the program.
Yeah, thank you for that. Before we wrap up, I did want to ask if there's anything else that you wanted to add or, you know, talk about in terms of ARCUP's, I guess, broader political strategy or, you know, anarchism, communism, you know, your approach to social transformation.
I feel like I covered it mostly. It's really just about like, yeah, having an organization that, you know, people can call their political home, where, yeah, it's kind of like a healthy vibe, which isn't always, yeah, it's not always like easy to come by in the left space. And yeah, like to, I guess, like find out more about us, we've got our positions on our website, which is arcup.org, or you can find us on Instagram at arcup.org. But yeah, in general, you know, like we just like to say the time is now to get organized. First Nations and migrants are under attack and have been for a long time. And the answer to these attacks, you know, is to be highly organized, politically and strategically united in our goals, not scattered across many campaigns and collectives with conflicting aims. So if you want comrades, not allies, if you want to build power that's capable of overcoming the issues your community face, get in contact with us.
Amazing. Look, Jade, thank you so much for speaking with us about ARCUP's work. And we'll have information in our show notes about how to find out more about the Migrant Power Program and just ARCUP's positions in general. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Priya.
And that was Jade, a member of ARCUP, who joined us to speak about the importance of building migrant worker power in the liberatory struggle against colonialism, racism, class exploitation, and fascism on these stolen lands. And as I mentioned before, we will have more information in our show notes about ARCUP and the Migrants Building Power Program. And you're listening to Thursday Breakfast. It is 8:23 in the morning.
We're talking about ecological thinning and subsidised logging, but we basically mean the same things, don't we, here?
Wherever there are chemical corporations around the world, they're constantly trying to chip away at regulations.
Earth Matters, bringing you environmental and social justice stories from developments in government and industry to the campaigns and communities that are standing up to them. Earth Matters plays at 11 a.m. Sunday and 6:30 a.m. Wednesday. Turn your dial to 855 a.m. or listen online at 3cr.org.au.
While the headlines have subsided, the nuclear power plant is still not under control, with the spent fuel rods removed from only one out of four reactors.
Law needs to change so that our rights can be recognised, so that decisions in relation to the use and exploitation of our lands is ours.
Help 3CR raise funds by donating your containers. Every eligible drink container that you return to a Container Deposit Scheme recycling point earns 10 cents, which can really add up. 3CR is a donation partner for Victoria's Container Deposit Scheme. The scheme allows you to recycle selected aluminium, glass, or plastic containers and donate the funds earned to a not-for-profit organisation of your choice. Help us raise funds for the station. Search for Community Radio and choose 3CR next time you cash in your cans. Go to cdsvic.org.au for more information.
We are coming up to time for Thursday breakfast for this week, but before we let you go, we'll just give you a rundown of what we covered on today's show, Thursday, the 18th of September.
The first part, we had interview with Tyler and Danny from Crisis Housing Reforms, a grassroots advocacy campaign focusing on change with Octarian crisis accommodation, and that they discussed two special sports release in the August this year from the Australian Institute of Health and Welfare concerning your experience homelessness.
After that, we had the second installment of Our Stories, Our Flats. This week on Our Stories, Our Flats, youth practitioner Sabrina Adem challenges the myth of ethnic enclaves, and the girls from Underground Women shared their experiences of living in Carlton and what they'd like to see change.
And after that, we heard a conversation that I recorded with Mananjali and South Sea Islander scholar and author Chelsea Watergo about the upcoming launch of Black Thoughts Matter, which is a selection of some of her most important essays published over the past decade. And Black Thoughts Matter is out with Common Room editions later this year.
And finally, we had an interview with Jade, a member of ARC UP, who joined us to speak about the importance of building migrant worker power in the liberatory struggle against colonialism, racism, class exploitation, and fascism on stolen land. ARC UP is an anarchist communist organization seeking to build migrant and indigenous class power through rebuilding a militant workers' movement, and is based on the lands of the Wurundjeri and Boonwurrung peoples of the Kulin Nation.
Amazing. I think this was a wonderful show, if I may say so myself. And remember, everyone, stay tuned to Thursday Breakfast, like every week, honestly, but especially for the next few, because next week we're going to have part two of that interview with Tyler and Danny from Crisis Housing Reform. And we're also going to have parts three and four over the next 2 weeks of Our Stories, Our Flats. And if you did miss the first episode of Our Stories, Our Flats, produced by the wonderful Ayan Shirwa, you can head to 3cr.org.au/Thursday-breakfast to get the podcast of last week's program. And for all of Our Stories, Our Flats show notes, you can head to 3cr.org.au/Our Stories, Our Flats. Thanks so much, guys. And we will catch you all next week. Bye.
Hi, everyone. My name's Robbie Thorpe. I'm with 3CR Community Radio. Every year we have a subscription drive. It's a way of supporting our organisation maintain itself through the year, and we rely on the support of the community. One way to do that is to subscribe and become a member. Become part of this organisation itself. Get in contact with 3CR. You can go to the website 3cr.org.au or you can ring on 9419 8377. 3CR ensures that our voices, Aboriginal voices, are heard on this radio station. So it's a good way of supporting Aboriginal people as well by becoming a subscriber for 3CR Community Radio.
Have you heard of long COVID? If you or someone you know have had COVID-19, you may still experience symptoms weeks or months later. There are many symptoms of long COVID, but the most frequent are extreme tiredness, shortness of breath, and muscle aches and joint pains. Anyone can experience long COVID, including children. You can find information in your language on the Health Translations website, healthtranslations.vic.gov.au. Just type long COVID as a keyword.
A 3CR supporter.
3CR Breakfast would like to thank the New International Bookshop, Melbourne's radical bookstore and venue, for their financial support of this program. You can find Nibs opposite reception in the Lygon Street wing of Trades Hall, Carlton. Keep up to date with upcoming events at nibs.org.au.